The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
When it comes to trade executive agreements, you could imagine something like Congress withholding appropriations until trade agencies are more forthcoming with what types of agreements they're entering into. Just to give a better sense of what actually is happening here, USTR reports each year that it's monitoring something in the range of 700 trade agreements of this sort. That's, as I said, about half of what actually is out there. But if you just look at those 700, my research has suggested that no one within USTR actually has a copy of many of them. So it's actually flying blind with respect to somewhere in the range of 10 to 20% of these agreements, despite saying that it's monitoring and enforcing them. So that, I would think, would be of concern to Congress. Resolving those issues could then become front and center. So short of that, you know, some differentiation with respect to how we treat TEAs, these trade executive agreements, would help. Just considering them a category in the first place and recognizing the work that they do would go a long way, I think, to helping sort some of the mess that we're dealing with now.
I'm Scott R. Anderson, and this is the Lawfare podcast for August 31st, 2020. Earlier this month, the Trump administration reimposed tariffs on aluminum imports from Canada, signaling a new salvo in the now years-long trade wars it has been waging with countless U.S. trading partners. But what gives the president the authority to pursue such measures unilaterally, even when he lacks support from members of his own party in Congress? To answer these questions, I sat down with two scholars of trade law that have been following and analyzing these issues closely, Kathleen Clausen of the University of Miami School of Law and Tim Meyer of Vanderbilt Law School. We discussed the scope of the president's authority over trade, where it came from, and what a future Congress might be able to do about it. It's the Lawfare podcast for August 31st. Trade war powers, past, present, and future. So on August 11th, we saw the Trump administration come and impose a new set of tariffs on aluminum imported from Canada. And as anybody who's been looking at the news for the last several years knows, this isn't the only time that that's happened in regard to Canada or aluminum, or in regards to other products and a number of other American trade partners. To the contrary, the Trump administration has proven quite willing on multiple occasions and on multiple fronts to use its authority over a trade as a point of both a sword and a shield, a way to combat and exercise leverage to change the terms on which U.S. trade agreements and trade arrangements exist. Can you tell us, Kathleen, give us some background on what led to this latest sort of salvo and how it fits into this pattern that we've seen the Trump administration pursue in regards to its use of trade authorities?
So this latest action is among a series that the administration has taken under an authority known as Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962. Although we could situate it in a larger collection, as you alluded to, of national security premised trade actions that the administration has taken over the last couple of years. But Section 232 has been the one that has been both challenged the most and discussed the most among trade policy folks. It allows the president to impose tariffs where imports are found by the Commerce Department to threaten to impair the national security. So the president did impose those tariffs on Canada, along with every other country in the world from which we get steel and aluminum, back in 2018. But then to to reach a deal on the new NAFTA, the US-Mexico-Canada agreement, USMCA, those were lifted. And the United States entered into a deal both with Canada and Mexico to stop those tariffs at that time. Now that the deal is done, the United States has changed course again. We could talk about why that might be. But nevertheless, it's from the same authority back a couple of years ago when it first instituted these steel and aluminum tariffs. This time, the United States says there's been a surge in imports from Canada, and that's why they went back and did this latest action. Canada said it plans to retaliate. So once again, we find ourselves where we were about 2 years ago, trying to figure out, does the president have this type of authority? Is it appropriate now after the two-year hiatus? All of this is part of this larger discussion on particularly Section 232 and our trade authorities more generally as they relate to national security.
So this level of executive branch control that we see the president able to exercise over trade strikes me as a little bit strange if you think about it from the context of first principles. Foreign commerce is one of Congress's most central constitutional authorities. The president really doesn't have much of a claim that he is the one who can direct how the United States engages in trade and investment and economic exchanges with the rest of the world on his own constitutional authority. And yet we've arrived at this point where in practice, he's very much able to do so, pointing to these enactments that Congress itself has pursued. Tim, put this in some historical context for us. How have we arrived at this outcome where the president has so much unilateral authority? And was this really Congress's intent, or is it the product of some other process that's been driving the way these authorities work out in practice?
Sure. So the history of trade is sort of a very complicated one. But if you think about, if you take sort of the post-war period, what you've seen is really the evolution of a dual-track system. On the one hand, the president goes out and negotiates trade agreements pursuant to a negotiating mandate that he's given from Congress, and then he brings back the trade agreement. And if Congress approves the trade agreement through legislation, Congress gives the president the authority then to lower trade barriers, most notably tariffs, in compliance with the terms of the agreement. But alongside that set of delegations from Congress is a set of what Kathleen has very helpfully termed sort of a trade security exceptions that give the president pretty significant authority to raise trade barriers if he decides that there is some sort of threat to the national security. So Section 232, as Kathleen mentioned, is the most clear example of this. It dates actually originally from the 1950s. Although the current version of it is from the Trade Expansion Act in 1962. There are other authorities here that date from the post-war period up through the 70s that trade lawyers think about. Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, which has been the basis for the Trump administration's tariffs on Chinese imports. The International Emergency Economic Powers Act, IEEPA, as the successor to the Trading with the Enemy Act. Those statutes, among others, provide the president with fairly broad powers that he can use to regulate trade in response to what he deems to be national security threats. Now, how did we end up where we are today? Well, I think a lot of that has to do with the really open textured language of some of these statutes, particularly Section 232. Section 232 instructs the president and the Secretary of Commerce to look at a broad range of factors when they are assessing what constitutes a threat to the national security of the United States. Those factors include a series of factors that we might all agree are sort of related to defense production, but it also includes a bunch of factors like the economic welfare of the nation, the economic health of specific industries, unemployment, government revenue, and any other factor the president deems relevant. So Congress in 1962 wrote in this really broad grant of authority that basically authorizes the president to consider the economic health and security of the nation as part of national security. Now, when Congress did that, Congress probably expected the president to exercise some restraint in how this would actually be applied. And so throughout history, most of the actual uses of Section 232 have been in the energy sector, particularly about oil during the 1970s. And 232 had sort of in the WTO period, the post-1995 period, had really sort of fallen into disuse. And the Trump administration really sort of picked it up and was willing to use it to execute a broader program, broader economic policy that was aimed at shoring up the manufacturing base in the United States through these aluminum tariffs that you mentioned, also steel tariffs. And the administration has also found that auto and auto imports represent a threat to the national security of the United States, although so far they haven't imposed any restrictions on the import of those products.
So trade is, of course, isn't the only policy area in which we see the Congress delegating authority to the executive branch in substantial swaths. And we associate a lot of those delegations with the administrative state, the set of rules that governs how decisions are made, how they're reviewed. It brings the courts into the process. It provides avenues by which private citizens and advocacy groups can engage in the process. But trade law and trade policy don't fit as readily within the conventional administrative state administrative law process that we associate with the Administrative Procedure Act and similar sort of provisions. Isn't that right, Kathleen? Can you give us some background about what the trade administrative state really looks like?
Yeah, you're totally right, Scott. Today, we have a very far-reaching trade administrative state beyond what has existed through our nation's history. Agencies across the branch, everything from agriculture to homeland security, are now engaged in trade lawmaking of some variety. That is, they're regulating foreign commerce. Now, some of this comes from delegations that have been given to them either directly from Congress or subdelegated to them by the president, but not all. The result is that they're engaging in sort of three directions simultaneously. On the one hand, they are trying to engage with the White House and with Congress on what trade policy should be in a sort of vertical direction, if you will. On the other hand, they're engaging in a robust interagency policymaking mechanism where they talk to each other. And then on the sort of third hand, they are engaging diagonally, which I think is the most important area. That is, they're working directly with their foreign counterparts, making agreements, entering into all sorts of arrangements. So as I said, some of this comes from delegations, but some of it has developed organically such that we now have highly entrenched practices in most of these agencies when it comes to trade lawmaking. This is a pretty significant change, as I said, even if some of it was intentional. If you look back at our nation's history in the early days, you can see how the president is treated in our trade statutes as a trustee of sorts. That is, Congress would make trade policy, and then the president would be asked to make adjustments where it was in the public interest. Then, as things evolved, more authority was given to the president. He had greater discretion when it came to trade policy, and he was more like the agent of a principal that Congress was. Now we have still another system that is more managerial in nature, but the president isn't the manager. It's the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, USTR, that really coordinates and manages across many agencies. Not all. Notably, there are some parts of our trade policy that are outside USTR's purview. But it is highly engaged in rulemaking itself, overseeing the rulemaking of other agencies, different types of adjudication, enforcement, monitoring. It's a huge role that USTR has. And as you suggested, throughout all of this, the traditional administrative law disciplines don't typically apply to USTR and sometimes don't apply to other agencies on trade-related matters either. And so we're left trying to figure out precisely what accountability mechanisms there really are in this broad trade administrative state. It seems that when it's convenient, these trade-related agencies can claim exceptions to our traditional doctrines, such as under the Administrative Procedure Act, by saying they're working on foreign affairs, which is a statutory exception. On the other hand, when they're called upon to act like foreign affairs agencies under State Department rules, they claim exceptions there as well. So as I said, this compounds what is already a sort of living on the edge of legality with some of these delegations in what some of these agencies are doing, especially when we're talking about negotiating agreements with trading partners.
I would just add to that, I think everything Kathleen said is spot on. And I would just add a specific point, which is that, you know, we sometimes think, and perhaps Congress sometimes thinks, that if they give the president the authority to take a particular decision, so under Section 232, it's for, in the first instance, the president that actually imposes a measure like the aluminum tariffs that we started the conversation with. He can then delegate the exclusion process to the Commerce Department, as Kathleen mentioned. But, you know, we might think that if you give the president that kind of authority, the president is the actor in the executive branch who is most accountable. And it turns out that the president is not subject to the Administrative Procedure Act at all. So in addition to the sorts of foreign affairs exceptions that Kathleen talked about, there's this additional issue that you can't review under the Administrative Procedure Act decisions that are made by the president, which is going to cover a set of these kinds of trade delegations.
Let me go back to one issue you raised, Kathleen, and that is the role that agreements, particularly with foreign powers, play in trade inherently. Trade is, of course, the product of agreements. It's a bilateral process, in some ways a foreign affairs process. Trade agreements play into that. I know you've done some writing on trade executive agreements, the types of agreements that are used more often these days around these sorts of trade issues. Tell us about how those are used and how those are fit into this division of authority between Congress and the executive.
Thanks, Scott. The trade executive agreements are, just to give a sense of what we're talking about here to folks, these are agreements that are sometimes delegated to the executive branch to negotiate, but then there's no congressional oversight after that. So Congress basically says, go forth and negotiate an agreement in this area, but we don't need to see it after you're done. It just enters into force whatever the executive decides. Now, that's not true for all of these. I want to be clear. There are some agreements that have been negotiated, and we're talking now back to the beginning of the 20th century. This is not a new phenomenon, but there are some that maybe are more of questionable authority than others. How many of these are there? That's been a central question of my research, and we don't really know. Just to give an example of what this might be, we're talking about things like the latest agreement with Japan. There were, in fact, two agreements, a trade agreement and a digital trade agreement that was negotiated with Japan. We could put the phase one China deal in this category. We could look at the numerous side letters to the USMCA. There are so many different types of these things, but we just don't know exactly how many there are because no one keeps a collection of them, not USTR, not the State Department. So the result is, of course, not only does the public not know about many of these, Congress also does not know about many of these. And so that's how it fits into some of these concerns some of us have about the separation of trade law powers. In what I've found so far in the research that I've done, we're talking at least about 1,200 of these types of agreements that regulate everything from tomatoes to titanium, not just whether they can come into the United States, but under what conditions they can come in. And so, as I said, part of the reason we don't know about them is that the process for negotiating them is different from most of our other executive agreements, but also transparency and institutional memory. All of these issues have been a problem for some time. At the end of the day, they serve a super important purpose. We need these to actually move goods and services in and out of our country. That's critical in that respect. But right now, they've been sort of under the radar. But what I'm concerned about is that they could be under the table, and we don't want that. So they're sort of on the borderline of being totally lost from the attention of both the public and the Congress. So that brings us back to what we were talking about earlier about the need for more administrative law disciplines or more engagement with Congress on some of these types of agreements.
Well, that raises a real issue here, which is the extent to which Congress, who again is the font from which this authority flows, is the party actually vested with the responsibility for overseeing foreign commerce and trade and its other iterations, is aware of what's happening, can monitor what's happening. Tim, tell us a little bit about how oversight has worked in this space. How effective is it? Can Congress engage on these issues when it wants to? And does it do so, I guess, in the ordinary course? Or is this a set of issues in which it just doesn't quite have the capacity to keep up with what the executive branch is doing?
I think the answer is that Congress has tried to keep up with what the executive branch is doing. That the executive branch, as you know, and Kathleen just described this perfectly. Her research is fascinating on this point. That the executive branch is inclined to push at the limits of its authority, whether that's doing trade executive agreements that may not be easy to find or may not be obviously linked to a specific delegation, or whether it's some of these national security actions under Section 232 that are highly visible but are difficult to review either in the judicial context or Congress. You just see the executive branch pushing to sort of test how much it can do unilaterally. Congress has tried in a number of these statutes to rein in the executive branch. So there have been amendments to these statutes. In Section 232, Congress inserted in the 1980s what is effectively a legislative veto provision for uses of the statute related to oil, which is how it had been primarily used in the 70s. Well, the Supreme Court then turned around and said the legislative veto is unconstitutional, thereby removing one of Congress's efforts. In the context of IEEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, the underlying requirement there is that the president declare a national emergency. And so in reforming the emergency's infrastructure, Congress put some limits on how long an emergency can last. The president has to redeclare an emergency. In the 232 context, the statute requires that the Commerce Secretary's findings with respect to whether a product threatens the national security of the United States be published so that there's some accountability on that front. The Trump administration has refused to make public the report on finding that autos and auto imports represents a threat to the national security. When they refused to do it under Section 232, Congress passed a law that required them to do it by January 19th of this year, 2020, a date certain. And the executive branch determined after OLC, the Office of Legal Counsel, issued a memo that it wasn't required to do so constitutionally. That would interfere essentially with its foreign affairs powers. So this is an area in which the kind of monitoring and soft procedural reform, Congress has tried that, and it hasn't really been terribly effective. And that might not be that troubling in a context in which there's a high degree of trust between the administration and between Congress. But in a context, which I think maybe we are in right now, where Congress is much more distrustful of the administration, you know, Congress is going to have to think about, I think, some more serious potential kinds of reform. Now, in the national security area, there's a clear trade-off, right? We'd like the president to have a broad, and the executive branch generally, to have a broad range of authorities that allow them to flexibly respond in the case of a crisis. Actually restricting those kinds of emergency authorities is a potentially kind of difficult task for Congress to undertake and poses risks. On the other hand, these very broad authorities that are really just sort of subject to transparency and monitoring requirements don't do very much to rein in an administration that wants to use these national security authorities to enact what is basically a domestic economic program. And that's really what the Trump administration has done. The tariffs on China and the steel and aluminum tariffs, they have some foreign policy objectives, particularly the tariffs on China, but they've had huge domestic economic effects that the president is able to effectuate without really having to be accountable either to Congress or to the judiciary.
Now, of course, we're talking about the use of these authorities in the context of the current administration, which had used them to advance a particular political and policy agenda. But it doesn't have to be the case. Future presidential administrations may have different policy priorities that could be pursued using the same set of tools in good ways and bad ways, depending on your perspective on those policies. Tim, you've done some writing recently on one of these. Can you give us a little bit of an idea about the ways other presidential administrations might use these authorities, both good and bad?
So there's a huge range of potential uses for these emergency authorities. And so we could be talking about IEEPA or Section 232 are the two that are probably the most unbounded. The Section 232, as I said earlier, has a conception of national security that is incredibly broad. It basically includes anything that affects any sector of the economy or the economy as a whole, as long as that effect is caused by imports that can be regulated. So, you know, it's pretty easy to imagine a future environmentally minded administration that would look at Section 232 and think, you know, this is a vehicle for potentially imposing some sort of carbon border adjustment mechanism. You know, Scott, as I'm sure you recall, after the President Obama negotiated the Paris Agreement, there wasn't a potential for comprehensive climate legislation from Congress. And so he turned to domestic delegated authority under the Clean Air Act as a means of implementing the U.S. commitments under the Paris Agreement. Now, one risk when you raise environmental standards is that companies will just offshore production to some country that has lower environmental standards, and therefore you don't actually achieve the environmental purpose of the domestic regulation. We call this carbon leakage. And so the way you prevent that is you impose some sort of carbon border adjustment that results when those products come back into the United States, right? They have to pay a tariff or they can't come in unless they meet the domestic regulatory standards. I think 232 would provide a future administration the authority to implement some sort of carbon adjustment mechanism like that. The European Union is already moving ahead with its own domestic process to implement a carbon border adjustment mechanism. So the United States wouldn't necessarily be a first mover here. It would actually be the European Union. And Section 232, one of the things it allows the president to do is Congress has given ex ante consent to international agreements that address the national security threat identified by the Commerce Secretary and the President under the process that's set out in 232. So 232 could be used as the legal basis for an international agreement on a border adjustment, a carbon border adjustment mechanism that could really do a lot to spur decarbonization in other countries if it was coupled with domestic regulation of the kind that President Obama envisioned when he was in office.
That's fascinating. And the downside of that presumably would be that it just would only be as durable as the presidential administration remained in office necessarily, that there'd be a risk of reversal if a subsequent administration adopted a different view. It would not be no obligation to remain to keep those policies in place as they would if they were embedded in legislation.
Yes. So that's always the risk with anything that's done by delegated authority. And in here, it would even be easier because, again, as we've already talked about, the Administrative Procedure Act wouldn't apply. So there wouldn't even be a requirement to justify the removal of the measure. Now, this is where this sort of ties into these kinds of reform questions, which is, you know, your question suggests, and I think many people feel, you know, the better route here would be on climate to have congressional legislation. And in the context of these national security authorities, to have some sort of reform that tries to set out a process or a series of authorities that are not prone to the kinds of abuses that we've seen in the last few years. And so that's where there's, you know, a possibility to do some sort of package deal here. You know, one of the tricks to reforming any of these authorities, to clawing back power, is that has to be done through legislation. And so unless Congress has the votes to override a presidential veto, the president is going to have to consent to that. And so you could imagine a president implementing some sort of mechanism, or at least thinking about implementing some sort of mechanism under Section 232, something like a carbon border adjustment mechanism, or it could be some other priority that a future administration has, and being willing to trade some of that authority under Section 232 for entrenching the measure in legislation going forward.
Well, that question of reform really brings us to the next thing I want to talk about, because we have seen a number of reform proposals brought forward in Congress, particularly a few years ago when we were at the height of kind of the trade wars, and some of the Trump administration's actions were proving particularly controversial, even among members of his own Republican Party in Congress. But Kathleen, tell us a little bit about what those reform proposals look like and where they've gone, and to what extent there looks like there's an appetite for reform in the Congress as it currently stands.
Well, the short answer is they've pretty much gone nowhere. As you said, these, as the security premised actions were breaking and seemingly expanding to a wide range of products, including products like import cars, that's where we started to see some bipartisan dialogue as to what could be done here to rein in some of this authority. But they're pretty much dead in the water. Most of the proposals that were explored at that time had to do with Section 232. Many of them had intended to go a long way toward creating more checks, defining national security more clearly, engaging the Department of Defense and an independent agency known as the International Trade Commission. So they were really getting into the pros and cons of how much decision-making should be in the hands of the administration as compared to independent agencies or Congress. But we've heard in recent months that the political appetite for moving those forward has waned. And as Tim was suggesting a moment ago, a White House veto was nearly certain in any event. So anything would have had to been wrapped up in a larger package. But we know now those are not going to move. This has put a bit more pressure on the courts to sort of fill in the gap. But there, too, there's little space for movement. So the prospects at the moment, Scott, seem very low. And I might add, though, that even though I mentioned some positive aspects for reform that they had thrown around at that time, they didn't address some practical issues that both industry and agencies have faced. Whether the president can make modifications like he has done, how far he can go with agreements into which he's entered on these issues, like the Canada situation we mentioned at the outset. How exclusion processes, these are where companies can petition to be excluded from the tariffs on products they import, how those ought to work, those were largely left out of the reforms. And so even if they had advanced, I will say I was not that hopeful that we would have seen major change. And that's just in the context of national security premised actions. We're far from a discussion on reforms that would address the broader institutional issues that I highlighted earlier, even though in a way the time for that is somewhat ripe because the president's authority to enter into trade agreements, a statutory program known as fast track authority, that's up for renewal next year. So we could be talking about some of these authorities now in that context, but so far we really aren't.
I would just add one small point to that, which is, some of these reform efforts, where they landed, particularly in the Senate on the Finance Committee, was with the idea that in order to try, if there was any hope, which it does not appear that there is, but if there was going to be any hope, you were going to have to grandfather in the current administration's policies. And so, if you're thinking about, how a Congress might approach trying to rebalance these considerations, there's probably a lot of benefit in terms of actually having the revision process function in thinking about the use of grandfathering mechanisms and sunrise clauses, where you defer the revision until after the next presidential election. And just the advantage of that may or may not be a first best world, but the advantage of it is that it gives a president who is inclined to think that the separation of powers is a principle worth respecting and something that's worth revisiting, but he's not inclined to give up his own ability, his or her own ability to act while in office. It allows the president to achieve both of those objectives and therefore gives he or she the incentive to actually negotiate meaningfully with Congress on reform.
So the prospects for reform right now sound not great, I think, is the takeaway point from what you all have described. But a big part of that, it seems like, and I think this is a recurring trend we've seen over the last 4 years, has to do with the partisan dynamics in the Congress and around the administration, and particularly because a lot of the reform proposals are responding and stem from a desire to curb this administration's use of some of these authorities, which inherently makes it more likely to come into that veto area where you require support from 2/3 to override veto authority to enact reforms over a president's objection. A new president could change that formula. You could have a presidency, at least in theory, that would come in willing to maybe embrace some changes that would even limit their authority on the assumption that would also limit the authority of future presidents with contrary policy preferences. Although, in practice, most presidential administrations tend to end up favoring executive authority maybe even more than they did when they're running for office once they get into that office. So it's worth thinking at least a little bit about what reforms could look like. Tim, tell us a little bit about how it would look or how it could look for Congress to try and reclaim some of the authority over these trade issues, particularly by kind of limiting some of these broad delegations it's given, the Section 232s, maybe IEEPA as well, though that's not strictly a trade provision, where these broad terms like national security, national emergency are used without much definitional content. Is there some potential for Congress to begin to flush those out in a way that actually will have an impact? Or is it really inherent in the policy judgment of this sort of space and the way the courts approach it that the president's going to have a lot of authority if there is any sort of substantial delegation?
I would start just by returning to what Kathleen highlighted earlier, which is just the importance of the administrative structure here, as well as the judicial review of actions taken pursuant to that structure. You know, we have a system in the trade remedies context, anti-dumping duties, countervailing duties, where the Court of International Trade can hear cases, and we have a fairly, you know, functional system of judicial review. So this isn't, trade is not a categorically an area where we couldn't design a system of judicial review, but it would require Congress to make, first of all, clear that it wants judicial review and to address a number of the limitations that prevent judicial review and address them across a range of different authorities that might substitute for each other, right? So if you reform only Section 232 without reforming IEEPA, then you might just push some executive action from 232 to IEEPA. So you have to really think about the way in which these different authorities can be used as substitutes for each other, and then ensure sort of comprehensive judicial review under the APA. You need to make clear that the exceptions don't apply to certain kinds of determinations. Make clear that, for instance, delegated decisions from the president are, as they've been treated by the courts, are subject to APA review. I think, Scott, you know, absent the Congress really making clear that it wants the courts to review these kinds of actions through limiting the sort of off-ramps that the courts have tended to use in this space, other kinds of reforms to the statute are not going to have a lot of teeth. The courts are just really uncomfortable with wading into deciding whether or not the president or the Secretary of Commerce has made a correct evaluation of whether or not something is a national security determination. The courts will always say that they can review action for whether or not it is in excess of statutory authority. And so in principle, the idea that they would say, well, this is beyond the scope of what is a national security action, that's held out there. But it's a difficult thing to do. And so I think Congress would really have to hold the court's feet to the fire. Now, having said that, there are things that the courts are more comfortable doing, and there are ways that they could do it. So the courts have been willing to enforce timelines and time limits in these statutes. And so 232 contains a series of time limits in which the Commerce Department and then the president have to act. And the courts have said, you know, we're going to hold the president to those time limits. You could build in more of those kinds of things. And in particular, you could impose time limits on the actions that the president takes. So currently, the president can impose virtually any measure he wants to adjust the imports of a product, and those measures can stay in place indefinitely. It's totally at the discretion of the president. So it would be a relatively straightforward revision to the statute to put limits on the kinds of measures the president can impose and the length of time for which he can impose them. And that would start to make some of these national security authorities look like some of these more ordinary trade remedies that we have. The other thing you could do is, of course, revise the definition of national security. I listed a whole bunch of factors that are included in the statute. And if Congress didn't want a president to have the authority to consider a very broad notion of economic security, it could cabin the definition of national security. Now, as we know, national security is sort of an ever-expanding concept and one where the executive branch is sort of constantly pushing at the limits of what constitutes a national security matter. So I don't think that just amending the definition of national security is going to prevent the executive branch from really trying to test the outer limits of the authority, but it would give the courts something more to hang their hat on. And, you know, I'll just end by telling a story, which is I was involved in some litigation around Section 232 and its constitutionality. And the government was asked in an argument whether or not Section 232 would permit the president to regulate the import of peanut butter on national security grounds. And the government's answer was essentially, yes, under certain circumstances, if the president made the requisite findings, then the president could regulate peanut butter. And the government won that case. So, you know, you really see under the current definition just a broad deference to the executive branch's determination about national security. And, I do think some cabining of that definition would do something, again, subject to the president's pushing on the limits of national security.
So the substantive scope of that delegation is one avenue of potential reform. But another one that you've already hit on, Kathleen, is this process question, is the procedural steps and boxes that have to be checked to be able to arrive at certain policy outcomes and policies. And that's another area where we've seen Congress imposing certain restrictions, whether it's timelines, whether it's certain prerequisites by other officials before being able to move forward a certain action in this sort of trade policy space. What potential do you see for there to be real substantial changes in those sorts of policies that might be able to strike a balance between the two branches that's more amenable towards Congress's preferences, if that is the sort of thing a new Congress comes in wanting to do, and with a president who's willing to accept those limitations?
Well, I think a lot of the issues we're seeing, certainly with the national security exceptions, fall along the lines of what Tim described. That is to say that a big part of the procedural type things that could change is related to judicial review and particularly strict timelines. More of that could be useful, really shifting the pendulum away from thinking about the balance between the branches and thinking more about what are other types of administrative disciplines that could be added here, tightening loopholes where statutes are ambiguous or silent, maybe structural changes, shifting the authority to independent agencies like the one I mentioned earlier, the International Trade Commission. A lot of what happens on the agreement-making side is a separate process apart from other State Department processes that we usually see in the executive branch and foreign affairs. And so revisiting this trade interagency committee process would be useful. All of this comes with the caveat that we could benefit from increasing transparency obligations to get a better understanding of what actually is happening. I had the benefit of speaking with a number of government officials in the research that I've done, but it became very clear that not many others outside of these agencies have a sense of what's actually happening within them. So transparency obligations would go a long way. And frankly, some organization, when it comes to trade executive agreements, you could imagine something like Congress withholding appropriations until trade agencies are more forthcoming with what types of agreements they're entering into. Just to give a better sense of what actually is happening here, USTR reports each year that it's monitoring something in the range of 700 trade agreements of this sort. That's, as I said, about half of what actually is out there. But if you just look at those 700, my research has suggested that no one within USTR actually has a copy of many of them. So it's actually flying blind with respect to somewhere in the range of 10 to 20% of these agreements, despite saying that it's monitoring and enforcing them. So that I would think would be of concern to Congress. Resolving those issues could then become front and center. So short of that, you know, some differentiation with respect to how we treat TEAs, these trade executive agreements, would help. Just considering them a category in the first place and recognizing the work that they do would go a long way, I think, to helping sort some of the mess that we're dealing with now.
So one challenge to these reforms is that trade is an issue that people come to with a certain perspective. You have people who believe in free trade, certainly, but increasingly you have people who believe that trade inherently, particularly free trade, doesn't always benefit the United States, or at least it doesn't always benefit all parts of the United States equally enough to make it worthwhile. But Tim, you've written a little bit about how you might be able to adjust the trade system, these institutions adjusting trade policy and the legal framework around it to open up the toolkit for better ways to adjust those concerns while still facilitating trade as a whole. Give us some a bit of an overview of those ideas and how you see trade reform fitting into those questions of economic distribution and redistribution.
Sure. Thanks, Scott. So, you know, I think we started this conversation with national security and the national security authorities. And I think one of the things that you've seen is that these national security authorities are useful for an administration that is trying to find a way to address some constituency that feels like the trading system isn't functioning properly. And so, you know, in the current administration, the Trump administration has said, look, we can help steel workers and aluminum workers. Maybe we can help them out by imposing protection under Section 232. And, you know, that's going to respond to their concern that the trading system and liberalized trade in particular doesn't necessarily serve their interests. So that's not the only way that we can think about trying to serve their interests. And there might be other ways to build into the trading system some responsiveness to these kinds of economic inequality and economic distribution concerns that would take some of the pressure off of these security exceptions as outlets for that kind of pressure, while also vindicating what is, I think, you know, our responsibility to worry about our fellow citizens and whether or not we're adopting economic policies that really are in their interest. So one idea here would be to have what I think of as an economic development chapter in trade agreements. And what an economic development chapter would do is it would do two things. The first is it would require the government to monitor at a much more granular level than it currently does the impact of trade agreements. So the International Trade Commission that Kathleen mentioned earlier does do some monitoring. When there's a new trade agreement, it will assess the projected impact of the trade agreement. But this stuff tends to be at a pretty high level of abstraction. And, you know, we could imagine charging the ITC with doing a much more granular regional, community, race and ethnicity-based evaluation of how trade policies are impacting different communities, regions, and so forth. That would really give us a better sense of the sort of equity of our trade policy than we currently have. Right? It would create a transparency mechanism. An economic development chapter would require that monitoring, and then it would require the results to be made publicly available. That by itself might leverage some political pressure to make sure that we have a trade policy that really does speak to more Americans than our current policy seems to, in which we've got a number of our fellow citizens that feel like trade is really not serving their interests. The second set of reforms that you might have in economic development chapter would be at a general level, just a set of substantive obligations to adopt policies to help those communities, regions that are impacted by trade in an adverse way, right? So if the government determines that a certain sector, I'm in Tennessee, right? So if we determine that, for instance, Western Tennessee is trade impacted adversely, there'd be some obligation to adopt some set of policies. In the United States, what might those policies look like? Well, traditionally, we've looked to trade adjustment assistance as the vehicle through which we help workers, farmers, businesses that have suffered as a result of trade liberalization. But frankly, you know, nobody's ever really been too happy with the way trade adjustment assistance works. It's got a number of problems, but one of those problems is that trade adjustment assistance has never been embedded in trade agreements themselves. And so trade agreements, when they're done, they tend to last indefinitely. They don't have a term limit. The new USMCA does have, for the first time, a trade agreement with a somewhat convoluted sunset mechanism. But normally, there's no term to trade agreements. They just go on, and the executive branch implements them. Trade adjustment assistance, on the other hand, has to be reauthorized every few years. And so the entire program has to be re-upped so frequently that the proponents of the program have difficulty getting any traction to build the program out to a scale at which it might really address some of these dislocation issues that I think it's become increasingly clear in recent years have presented a significant problem across the United States. So, one thing you could do is you could just embed TAA in this economic development chapter to make it a little bit more secure. But other things you could do are sort of broader based investment in these kinds of communities. And so here we could think of infrastructure programs. So for instance, a community that was designated as being adversely impacted, it might be eligible or it might have a special claim for infrastructure grants from the Department of Transportation. It might have a special claim to education funds, right, to invest in public schools and colleges in the region designed to educate and boost the economic potential of the folks that live in that region. You could imagine doing some of this through a program sort of like Opportunity Zones. Now, Opportunity Zones have some problems, but you could imagine designating and giving various forms of tax relief for investment in these areas in order to spur economic activity. I think if you were to have something like an economic development chapter, and there's a variety of different specifics that you could incorporate into the program, that would be a way to sort of say to these communities that feel like, we've really gotten the short end of the stick on trade, that the government has heard them. It's taken steps within the trading framework to address their concerns, and it would go a long way toward defanging the need to turn to these security exceptions as a vehicle to impose economic policies that speak to those communities, but maybe are not terribly effective at actually delivering the kind of long-term assistance that's going to help them get on their feet.
So I think as we are all well aware, we are just a few months away from a national election, and then a few months past that to potentially not just a new president, but also a new Congress in both chambers. And that opens up a lot of new potential for legislation in this space and policy for this space, or at least it might. If it does, what is the kind of last piece of advice, or at least the first piece of advice, I should say, that you would pass on to that new Congress, to that new president, about the authorities in the space? What is this should be their top priority to address insofar as they're willing to engage in a reform agenda? And how would you advise they go about it? Kathleen, let me start with you.
So we spent a lot of this time talking about domestic focused and domestic targeted reforms and programs. But I really think that the next administration needs to be most focused on the international aspects of how these play out. And so in that respect, I'd pick three R's, that is relationships, re-engagement, and revisiting. Relationships with trading partners, whether through the lens of what we've done in the last 3 years, that is through these tariffs or through agreements or otherwise. Second, re-engaging with the World Trade Organization, something that we haven't talked about in this discussion, but which remains an important part of our trade policy and our trade rules. And third, revisiting where, if anywhere, tariffs are serving a useful purpose, these additional tariffs, that is. So this is not an easy area to make progress or even to define what progress means. I think the next administration will need to evaluate what's occurred in the last 3 years, which has been a pretty serious overhaul in approach, even if the targets have largely been the same, and especially so with respect to China. And then we'll need to think seriously about both the substance and the framing domestically and internationally.
Tim?
I would echo what Kathleen said. I think that's a very nice way to put it. I think re-engaging with our trading partners is going to be just a critical step for the new Congress, and if there is a new administration. I would add, though, that I think that re-engagement is likely to involve, you know, whoever the incoming administration is, they're going to have priorities that don't sit comfortably with the way the trading system, and in particular the way the World Trade Organization was operating 10 years ago. And I think it's become increasingly clear in the United States that there's just a bipartisan consensus that certain facets of the way the international trading system operates are gonna need to change. And so if there's a new administration, I think that's an opportunity for a new administration to sort of reach out to allies, rebuild those relationships, but to do so in a way that is constructive with respect to some of these priorities that the new administration might have, particularly with respect to the environment or with respect to domestic economic considerations that are not always squarely trade issues, but are certainly trade adjacent or trade impacted areas. And, you know, that's going to require, I think, folks to, and just to give an example, it's going to require folks to think about what are the actual policies that the new administration or a new Congress is interested in seeing implemented, and how do we present those to our allies. So Scott, you asked me earlier about the 232, potential 232 on carbon intensive imports as a means of imposing some sort of carbon border mechanism. Well, 232 doesn't have a great name these days because of how it's been used during this administration. So, you know, the next administration would really want to emphasize, I think, that, you know, we come in peace, we come to work multilaterally, we are prepared to work unilaterally. But, you know, we have the domestic authority to work multilaterally. And, you know, we'd like to see some movement on these fronts, be it the climate front, be it the China front. And that presentation of the specific policies in the context of, you know, we're open to multilateralism will, I think, really benefit the new administration in being able to achieve its objectives, both at home and abroad.
Well, we are out of time, and so we'll have to leave the conversation there. But Kathleen Klaus and Tim Meyer, thank you for joining us today on the Lawfare Podcast.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to rate and review this podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you might be listening. This podcast was engineered by Ian Enright of Goat Rodeo and edited by Jen Patia Howell. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.